Legacy news outlets are hollowed out. The FCC is weaponized. The president spreads conspiracy theories, and AI is speeding the collapse of our information ecosystem. What's the end game here? I'm Brooke Gladstone, co-host of WNYC's On the Media. Each week, we cut through the BS to ask the questions you need answers to. Don't be a passive consumer. Listen to On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Alex Wagner. I do not need to tell you that being an American right now is a wild ride. But as a longtime journalist, I am not interested in the noise or the fear-mongering. I'm interested in the stories at the heart of the headlines. That is why every week on my show, Runaway Country, I'm joined by folks in the middle of the crossfire. From disillusioned MAHA moms to newly fired immigration judges to Epstein victims themselves, to understand what it means to live through this political chaos as an actual human being. And now I'm excited to tell you that Runaway Country is available ad-free to Friends of the Pod subscribers. Friends of the Pod is the subscription that supports the work Crooked does as an independent media company and gives you a ton of great bonus and ad-free content. With the midterms approaching, you are going to need more content to keep you sane. And now you can find Runaway Country right there. Subscribe now at crooked.com/friends.
To Love It or Leave It, live from Hollywood. I'm John Lovett, and I too am a Spider-Man in the sense that people think it's humane to put me outside, but actually that just kills me. You think you're saving that spider? You're killing that spider. You're killing it either way. Just step on it. We've got a great show for you tonight, but first let's get into it. What a week. President Trump has ordered workers to rip up the new White House helipad they were installing, reportedly because he was unsatisfied with how it looked, even though the contractor told him it was actually quite beautiful under all that algae. Last week, images showed workers putting in a 100-foot-wide granite presidential seal, but by Tuesday, the seal had been removed. People are suggesting this is because Trump is a capricious dope focused on what he can control rather than all the many ways he's failed in a second term, but that is unfair. They had no choice but to rip it up. The contractors forgot to make sure Lindsey Graham was buried pointing toward the White House. Crews have been toiling around the clock as Trump hoped to have the new pad finished before Chinese President Xi visited in late September. Welcome to the White House, President Xi. Please direct your attention to this beautiful new helipad and not the massive pile of rubble where the East Wing used to be. Trump showing a Chinese dictator the White House like a four-year-old excited to show you his room. Look at where I land the helicopter. Look at where I build it. The White House has never had a helipad before, but needs one because the new helicopters that will serve as Marine One have exhaust vents that could scorch the grass. Plus, they'll need to burn more fuel to carry around Trump's fat ass. Got him. Said a White House spokesperson, thanks to President Trump, the White House has never looked better, and it will only continue to get better under his leadership. Fun fact, that spokesperson, extra blind Stevie Wonder. This week. You haven't heard about that extra blind version of Stevie Wonder. He's so extra blind. So blind. Like nothing. Because you know the rumors that Stevie Wonder can see. There are these rumors that Stevie Wonder can actually see. I don't believe them, but people, do you know about that? That there's people believe that Stevie Wonder is actually secretly not blind? Do you know about this? Yeah. Follow the money. This week, the House Ethics Committee recommended that GOP North Carolina Congressman and member of the Crooked Dozen, Chuck Edwards, be censured for persistent, unprofessional, and inappropriate conduct towards two young female staffers. Said Edwards, staffer, I just met her. Just wait. Edwards gave the two women numerous gifts, including personalized pink and blue handguns. It wasn't a big deal, though. They were left over from a gender reveal. Other gifts he gave the women include jewelry totaling over $1,000, designer purses, shoes, flowers, a laptop and cell phone, a KitchenAid mixer, a robotic vacuum, tickets to performances, and one-on-one dinners. insane. Chuck Edwards is 65 years old and has a wife he's been married to since 1980. What are you doing, man? Buy your wife a Roomba. A staffer said that when she stopped wearing a necklace that Edwards bought her, quote, he made a comment about how disappointed he is that I'm not willing to wear what he got me. More like, yuck, Edwards. According to the report, Edwards would call the staffers pretty and breathtaking. He paid for one of the women to get massages. He did yard work at her house, and he skipped votes in Congress to help decorate her Christmas tree. More like Cuck Edwards. Yes, it does appear that he never actually slept with either of these women, which is somehow both better and worse. I know it's mostly worse, obviously, but you know what I'm saying? It's like, even yuck. But also better that he didn't. You know what I'm saying? You get it, right? It's okay. It's like, yeah. And now I shall show you a picture of Chuck Edwards. He's seen here moments before holding a boombox outside the apartment of a woman who smiled at him once and who was born in 2002. Look at this fucking guy. After Edwards took a staffer to a casino and paid for drinks and gambling, the staffer texted him to thank him for a fun night. Several months later, he printed out that message, drew a heart next to it, and handwrote, quote, perhaps my proudest personal moment. What are you doing? My God, man, print out a text message from your wife. Edwards gave this same woman a custom-made puzzle, inviting her to attend an Adam Sandler show with him. On another occasion, he had approximately 30 different types of ice cream delivered to her house in an effort to cheer her up. I scream, you scream, we all scream for a restraining order. There's also this incident detailed in the report in which he wrote poems for a female staffer, including one that he read at her going away party in the congressional office, accompanied by a slideshow during which he cried. Several staffers present testified that they felt uncomfortable, which is so embarrassing. When I read a poem I wrote at the office, everybody loves it. On Wednesday, Edwards pulled the plug and he wrote on social media at 3:32 a.m., after much prayer and reflection, I've decided to withdraw from my reelection campaign. I will complete my current term. His statement concluded, please don't tell my wife about this. Meanwhile, Republicans are hard at work trying to make our progressive candidates look like loony leftists, and in some races, we're actually making it relatively easy for them. Take Wisconsin's gubernatorial frontrunner Francesca Hong, a 37-year-old DSA member who serves in the state assembly. In 2020, Hong fired off several tweets calling Thanksgiving a, quote, colonizer holiday that should be canceled. And I know what you're thinking. Is she a goth teen who just got asked by her grandma to pick up an extra can of cream of mushroom soup for the green beans? No, she's an adult woman who at the time had just won her first race for the state house. And when asked about it recently, she clarified with this.
I'm a chef, and one of the first meals that I made that was for the community when I was 16 was a Thanksgiving meal. But Thanksgiving is also a time that's incredibly painful for many people in our community. But you know, views can evolve. And the position that I'm running for right now, and I think my background as a chef, will actually help me become a better governor that's able to bring more people to the table.
I think it's fitting that she is a chef, because if Wisconsin ends up with an election-denying Republican as governor in 2028, we're pretty fucking cooked. A day later, she did do some cleanup.
My favorite holiday is Thanksgiving. Because I love
Thanksgiving.
Yep. I don't want to cancel it. I actually love it. But, you know, I'm going to be real. I'm kind of a curmudgeon when it comes to holidays in general.
And she's not lying there. Here are just a few of her holiday tweets from throughout the years. Quote, I do not enjoy fireworks. Quote, I do not allow myself to work Halloween weekend. Quote, IT bro who was working on our computer changed the background theme to snow and Christmas trees. I feel slightly attacked. Quote, looking forward to Valentine's Day service tomorrow. We'll be at peak resting bitch face to celebrate all the love. At this point, I'm just glad she didn't say her favorite holiday is 9/11. Bernie Sanders does have some reservations. Here's what he had to say to John on Wednesday's Pod Save America when asked if he would be endorsing Hong.
I noticed you haven't yet endorsed in the Wisconsin governor's race. What's your thinking there, and might you endorse? Or
I don't think so.
So how did we get here? Well, the campaign of Sarah Rodriguez, the current lieutenant governor, imploded over financial mismanagement. The former lieutenant governor, Mandela Barnes, who's been on this show, dropped out ahead of a story in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about rumors of inappropriate relationships with women. David Crowley, Milwaukee's county executive, had already dropped out and endorsed Rodriguez, but at the urging of Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers, jumped back into the race and is now trying to mount a comeback against Hong, even though voting has already begun. But as long as he's not as woke as Hong, we stand a chance.
So when people try to call me the establishment, I look at that as a slur.
Fuck. In other sordid primary news, Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey faced his primary challenger, Congressman Seth Moulton, in a debate that grew surprisingly contentious. I do have a soft spot for Ed Markey, but Moulton's main critique, Ed Markey has served a very long time and at 80 is asking for a term that would mean he's 86. At the end, in a narrowly divided Senate where any absence or illness could have real consequences, is fair. But then Moulton dropped this.
Senator, in the newly released Epstein files, your name appears repeatedly. But I just want to ask one question. And I ask it from the perspective of a father of two young girls at home. Why would you even take a meeting with a lobbyist on behalf of Jeffrey Epstein?
Now, normally I read the Epstein files before bed just to unwind, but I decided to go look right then and there. And Markey isn't in the Epstein files repeatedly in any meaningful sense, but he has repeatedly called for the files to be released. And Markey didn't take a meeting with a lobbyist on behalf of Jeffrey Epstein. Epstein, apparently, paid a lobbyist to help secure the release of an imprisoned son of a former president of Senegal. Colleagues of that lobbyist said they had, quote, an initial briefing with Markey, which in lobbyist speak could mean a phone call to a staffer or literally nothing. There is zero proof any actual meeting happened. Markey's office denies he or a staff were ever part of a briefing. And even if it had happened, there's no reason anyone would have known that there was a connection between the colleagues of a lobbyist from that lobbyist to Epstein. And that same lobbyist, by the way, the one that led Moulton to say he was disturbed as a father of daughters, had donated $2,000 to Seth Moulton between 2015 and 2020. Moulton did donate those funds to a charity, but he did that a couple weeks ago before launching this attack in that debate. And none of this stopped Moulton from posting a picture of Markey next to a picture of Epstein to repeat this allegation on social media. And I fucking hate this. And what I'd say to Seth Moulton, who I've interviewed in the past and for whom I genuinely have a lot of respect, is that you're using the abuse of women and girls and the evil of it in this shockingly cynical way. Here was Markey's response in the debate.
What you are doing right now is absolutely reprehensible. I have never had any relationship with Epstein. I have no business with him. And what you're saying right now is absolutely the worst of the playbook of destruction and character assassination, which is so characteristic of MAGA Republicans.
Added Markey, if you don't believe me, you can ask Epstein yourself. Oh, that's right, you can't, because I killed him. Over in pop culture news, One Night Only, the movie where sex is legal only one day a year, arrives in theaters this Friday. Raved one reviewer, who directed this, my friggin' wife? Men know what I'm talking about. What if we watch this together, ha ha, texted your boss, disgraced Congressman Chuck Edwards. I hate this holiday, added Francesca Hong. And finally, the trailer dropped for Wicker, a film about a fishmonger played by Olivia Colman who asks Peter Dinklage to make her a husband out of wicker, and boy, does he deliver.
He's wicker.
Wicker? If you ask me, they should have called it Sex and the Settee. All right. We have a great show for you tonight. And we'll be right back with Adam Conover.
Hey, don't go anywhere. There's more of Love It or Leave It coming up.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. BetterHelp has an average live therapy session rating of 4.9 out of 5 based on over 1.7 million client session reviews. The feedback from real people who have actually used the service speaks for itself. More than 6 million people have used BetterHelp globally. BetterHelp therapists have at least 3 years and 1,000 hours of hands-on experience. They also hold all required education, training, and certifications across a range of mental health specialties, meaning the perfect therapist for you could be a few clicks away. BetterHelp makes it easy to get started. Answer a few questions, get matched with a therapist based on your needs, and switch therapists at any time if it's not the right fit. You got to get therapy. Everyone needs therapy. You should be in therapy talking to somebody. I'm honestly not in therapy right now. And I know that's wrong, but I'm just so busy. But I know that I should probably just bite the bullet and make an appointment as soon as I can. And that's true for everybody. If you can, if you have that, you got to make the time because you need somebody to talk to about your problems. That's, you know, profesh. See the reviews, see who stands out, and see if BetterHelp is right for you. Visit betterhelp.com/love it. That's betterhelp.com/love it. Love It or Leave It is brought to you by Blinds.com. Imagine a home where the light behaves exactly how you want and you wake up on your own terms, not the sun's. Blinds.com has spent 30 years perfecting the window shopping experience. Backed by 50,000 five-star reviews and over 25 million windows covered, Blinds.com makes it effortless to transform your space. You're in good hands. Whether you go full DIY or use their licensed pros, you're always in the driver's seat. Need a hand choosing your style? Book a free consultation with a Blinds.com design expert today. They'll even ship samples to your door fast and free. Choose from a huge variety of style options at prices that fit any budget. Everything is backed by Blinds.com's 100% satisfaction guarantee because at Blinds.com, the only thing they treat better than windows, it's you. We love Blinds.com. We got great blinds from Blinds.com in our office. There are these electronic rolling shades because it was super sunny in there in the late afternoon. It would get really hot. And so we have these awesome shades that just make the office more comfortable and it's more flexible. And they did a great job and it was easy. So right now, Blinds.com is giving our listeners an exclusive $50 off when you spend $500 or more. Just use code LOVEIT at checkout. Limited time offer. Rules and restrictions apply. See Blinds.com for details. And we're back. We'll have Adam Conover out in just a moment. But first, the midterms are coming, and Friends of the Pod subscribers can tune in to this week's Polar Coaster, where Dan Pfeiffer breaks down what Tuesday's Michigan results mean for November. If you're thinking about becoming a Friend of the Pod, now is a great time to join. Your subscription unlocks access to our excellent Substack newsletters, including open tabs, ad-free episodes of all your favorite Crooked Pods, exclusive subscriber-only shows like Pod Save America, Only Friends, and much more. And to everyone who's already a Friend of the Pod, thank you. Your support helps power independent pro-democracy media that you can trust. All right, please welcome to the stage. He knows a lot, and boy, is he going to tell you about it. It's Adam Conover. Hey, buddy. Good to see you. Thanks for being here. All right. Hi.
Hi, everybody. How you doing?
Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Did you take the bus?
No, I drove here today.
I was bummed because you had a book in your hand. I was like, oh my God, what a...
That would have been great if I had read on the bus.
You're so well put together and you had a book in your hand. I was like, God, he's riding the bus here. So cool. Such a riding the bus.
Like, I made a lot of my career based on famously riding the bus. And then I did a stand-up special about it. And then after I recorded that stand-up special, I was like, that's enough of that for a while. And I got myself a nice little electric car, and I do take the bus quite often. I take the subway. Wonderful subway system we have in LA. It's really popping. But now I drive around a little bit too. Yeah, it's helped me enjoy Los Angeles.
I think that's good. I think there are a lot of people who must ride the bus, and we should have a good system for people that have to ride the bus.
Yeah.
But it would be a better LA if people who could choose to ride the bus sometimes as opposed to thinking that they must be a bus all the time people.
Transportation flexibility. And people are starting to say less in LA. I don't know anyone who rides the bus. That's
cool.
I literally met a guy who lived in LA for 30 years. I told him I rode the bus. He's like, oh, did you get a DUI? That's like a that's a joke people used to say. Riding the bus was literally code for I got drunk and I got a DUI.
Like, no, I didn't get a DUI. I'm an adult. I did coke and then drove home. Woke myself up. So now we both recently interviewed Bernie about AI.
Yes.
He's pretty worked up about it. What were your takeaways from that conversation?
My main takeaway is that he very charmingly pronounces it robot. He says robot. He says, AI and the robots.
Robot.
Yeah, and it's like, and he's doing it legitimately. Like,
yeah.
He's not like Dr. Zoidberg on Futurama where they're making fun of him. He literally is from 1930s Jewish Brooklyn, and he says, like, he knows the guy who invented the word robot, you know?
Right, well, it's like, he's saying it actually in the same way Zoidberg is saying it, because Zoidberg isn't saying it as a joke. The show's saying it as a joke. They're both saying it sincerely as robot. I like that.
You're saying that Bernie and Dr. Zoidberg legitimately knew each other? And
I think they could, you know, I think they have some sort of affiliation is certainly possible. They have similar energy.
No, I think his plan is really interesting. If you guys haven't heard, Bernie's plan is, A, he wants a national data center moratorium, which would be very popular, I'm sure. And then he wants to create a sovereign wealth fund where the U.S. owns half of all of the AI companies in stock, and then we pay people out. And like every American would like get a check, like an AI dividend check, like they get in Alaska from the oil companies, which I find like really fascinating, you know, because AI is built on a public good, which is the production of culture that every other human participates in, right? It's literally trained on every piece of text ever written. So every piece of text you've ever written on the internet, it's trained on. It's all of our cultural output. And so why shouldn't we participate in the same way that, you know, the FCC controls the airwaves because, hey, the public owns the air. No company can own the air.
Aren't I
and
trained?
Therefore, they can.
Yeah. Aren't I trained on the same outputs? Right. Like I'm trained on.
Don't do that.
I'm asking.
No. You're playing into their scheme when you're like,
I'm asking.
I'm just like the AI. I also am trained on outputs.
I'm asking you to respond to the
objection. You're a fucking person, you know?
Right, no, I know. I know that.
No, yeah.
But I'm saying, what would be the response? Like, I consume a lot of media. That media informs my views. I synthesize it and create something from it. I understand that there's a big difference between, first of all, the, you know, scale matters, right? Like, it matters if you throw away, you know, like a polluting company in the ocean. I once accidentally, you know, threw a can out by mistake, whatever.
Sure. Yeah.
There's a difference in scale that matters. And also I have meaning and have a consciousness and a soul, you know, and I think that's an important distinction, but like they are just consuming content.
Yeah, I mean, you're not a corporation, right?
But what I would say is it's wrong for them to, but just to take that to the logical conclusion,
yeah,
to not have you attack me for making a dumber point than I'm making, which is only to say it would be wrong if they stole all this information and then replicated it.
Yeah.
But they don't do that. They take that information and they do make something new with it, right?
I mean, I
don't think it's good.
I've never seen AI output that struck me as something new. Every piece of AI output I see strikes me as like the most generic averaging of everything I've ever seen before. You know,
sure.
I used to ask it, "Hey, can you write something new in the voice of Adam Conover, Adam Ruins Everything, my old show?" And it would output stuff I had done before. It would never come up with anything new. It's a remix of older stuff, right?
And well, that's a different. So I agree with that. That's a different. I am bearish on some aspects of AI because water skis can't pull a boat, right? Like I think, you know, that human beings create interesting and novel culture. This thing can synthesize it and replicate it or average it or produce kind of boring or kind of syrupy or, you know, saccharine versions of it, whatever. But human beings will create something new from the light of consciousness. That's a different matter than is it unethical is it unethical by definition for these companies to synthesize the product of what's on the internet?
Well, it's not just synthesization or whatever, synthesis, it's extraction, you know, because they end up replacing what that thing is, right? So just take Google, for example.
Yes.
Like Google is the main example of this. You know, Google used to be something that supported every publisher on the internet by sending them traffic. Now all of their traffic has plummeted because when people go to Google and ask a question, it shows the answer to you directly. Where did it get the answer? It got it from all of those web pages that it did not produce, right?
Right.
And now it's giving you the answer and it's starving those sites of traffic. Traffic to most websites has dropped by like 50 or 60%, which makes you like wonder why, like how Google thinks they're even going to go on this way because they're, you know, they're eating their own seed corn in a way.
Right. No, well, this is where it's like there is something about that a lot of AI, especially anything that is generative AI and this like new writing or imagery or whatever, it is predicated on a world in which humans make most of the art or make enough of the art that art is expected to be human.
Yeah.
And that there will continue to be new art for the machines to synthesize into future new art. But that might also be a limit on their ability to grow, right? There'll be a kind of equilibrium between how much they can destroy versus how much new needs to be created for them to be of value. Because if they're all frozen in amber based on the way we spoke in 2019 or 20 or whatever, then eventually we'll be like, I don't use AI. It speaks with the dumbest, it keeps calling me fam, you know?
Yeah, and you can picture them eventually, the company is going, oh, what if we just pay a couple painters and a couple writers to output new text to train our, you know, to give us enough variability in our training corpus to get new text out of it. Or we could maybe do something like what Bernie proposes and nationalize the companies, because what they are fundamentally extracting is a public good. It's something that is produced by all of humanity simultaneously. And then we can use that money to benefit humanity, perhaps by funding arts on a massive scale, like a lot of other countries do. That would be very nice. I find that like it's just a really fascinating argument. Conversations like this one. I think my concern or criticism is it really presupposes that the AI companies are producing value on a large scale, and that has like yet to be seen. They're saying that they're producing value. They're saying that it's the new industrial revolution. Bernie said that on my podcast, which I'm happy that he made that argument, but like I'm slightly skeptical, right? That they're actually producing as much value as they say they are. I have not found AI particularly useful. I'm not sure what most people find it useful for. And the companies that are like, you know, rushing to put AI into their businesses are not finding it particularly useful in their businesses, you know? And so we're still in this moment where it's like, is this a new industrial revolution, or is it, you know, a normal technology, meaning something that, like, you know, we end up using somewhat for the things it's good at. But, you know, even if it's as big as the cell phone, it's smaller than what they are currently saying it is and what Bernie is assuming it is. So I'm worried he might be, you know, believing the industry's line a little bit too credibly. But there's no way to prove that right now.
Yeah, I also do think there's this problem where AI, there's an old aphorism that AI is just the computers we don't have yet, right? It's just like, it's the next version. It's like, it's in Mission Impossible, the first Mission Impossible, Ving Rhames is like, I want those new Pentium 5 processors, thinking machines. And it's like, they're not that great. And so I sometimes think we call it AI and describe like, is this a new industrial revolution? It's like, well, I don't know about that, because we're talking about a technology that is both a kind of can serve as a great kind of super Google research assistant. It can make ugly art. It can do bad writing. It can also search for like variants in DNA. It can do things with, it can do a lot of different things, and each one of these have potential applications and are different and to varying degrees reflect the value of the technology. Like for me in my day to day, like I find its writing to be atrocious, and I've tested it in all kinds of ways, and it's like it's actually a very, very little use. Where it is very useful is as a research tool. I don't rely on anything it ever produces, but it does kind of, it can do a quick trawl and find a bunch of sources, and then I can go to those original sources, and that is useful, right? That is a valuable thing that did not exist before. Now, I don't know how valuable, but for me, that does help.
You know, it's really funny. Over the past couple of weeks, I was like, I use a paid search engine called Kagi, which is like a Google alternative that has a lot of features that I like. It's about $100 a year. They have their own private AI assistant, right? So I was like, well, you know, I'm paying to use this thing. Might as well use it a little bit for research purposes, right? Mm-hmm. And one of the nice things it does is it searches the web and it summarizes what it finds. Like, it shows it searching, right? So it's really easy to follow up on the sources. And I have been trying to learn to put in these new contact lenses. I've been prescribed scleral contact lenses. They're really big. You have to really open your eye wide. So I'm trying to learn how to desensitize my blink reflex. And so I was like, can you find
like things people have said help them desensitize their blink reflex. And it says, okay, well, here's a 10-step program. You know, hold your eye open and start touching the white of your eye lightly. If you want to, you can use the back of a spoon or you can use the little plunger that the contact lens comes with. But it didn't have a citation for that. And I said, well, okay, where did you find like the Reddit thread or the forum thread where people said you could touch it with the back of the spoon? And it said, oh, nowhere. I made it up. And I said, oh, it's a little concerning that you made it up. It said, oh, yeah, that is very concerning. Good point. And I was like, it's so quickly contradicted, like, its use as a research tool. And again, this is after 3 or 4 years of people saying, this is the worst it's ever going to be. Oh, it's going to get so much better. To me, it's about as good as it was a couple of years ago. And the other thing about that argument that it's going to be, you know, oh, it's the next computer is, like, large language models do seem useful for some stuff, or token, whatever, the, you know, token neural networks. But it still only does that, right? It has the weights of the tokens and it produces output based on the input. That itself seems like it has limited utility. And a lot of what people are imagining when they talk about AI is something that like a token processing neural network doesn't seem like it could accomplish at all. Like a lot of the things that humans do are not, have nothing to do with just like comparing weights of words or pixels, right?
Right.
Because the world doesn't actually come in weights and pixels. And like occasionally someone has to like actually fucking move through space and like make a coffee, you know, like you know what the economy actually runs on? My grandmother's bedpan needs to be changed. And the person who changes my grandmother's bedpan needs to eat some food and the food needs to be brought to her house and it needs to be prepared. And like the world is made of people and I have yet to see the evidence that like, you know, 80% of jobs are automatable in that way. I just don't think it's fucking true. And, you know, I love the idea of nationalizing 50% of like any industry, basically. I think that's probably a good idea.
Say that shit for Hassan Piker's stream. All right.
Sure. We can explore that. But like, you know, do we actually believe the claims of the companies or not? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. That it's very hard because it is like this sort of the mystical quality of the debate, the way it kind of gets blurred, like, are they going to become conscious? Well, it doesn't need to become conscious to be extraordinarily capable and to disrupt a lot of the jobs. And also, we don't know what consciousness is, so I'm not going to be sure I know what a computer
has. When people start talking about it, is it, will AI become conscious? I want to shoot myself in the head with a gun. Like, I'm like, I you know, I did philosophy 101 was 19
that's
years
what,
old.
That's
I don't
what
need
the
to get stoned
want.
On the porch with you, buddy,
yeah,
you know?
No, I Sorry, know. Go. No, you're right. You're right. I shouldn't have interrupted. You're making a good point. I was just sort of struck by the... by the threat. is there something you've wanted to debunk lately?
Oh, that's a really good question. Something I have wanted to debunk lately. You know, I just did a video on my YouTube channel that made people very mad about all the downsides of our sudden shift to work from home as a culture. And that was based on a lot of my own experience and like other folks that I've worked with. And it's really interesting, like work from home, like systemically, like disadvantages young people who have trouble like getting and keeping jobs. Because, you know, when you're trapped in a Zoom box, you like can't like interact with other people. You're treated like much more like a little, you know, bit in a you know, a system that can be easily dispensed with. And it's a lot harder to like unionize remote workplaces if you care about, you know, labor rights. And I've been thinking a lot about the real world and how important your presence in the real world is and how much power it gives you, you know. And I think that like work from home is really it's huge advantages for so many people, disabled folks, you know, parents of young kids, et cetera, et cetera. For many, many people, it's great. But I think that like workers have run to it so much, we've sort of like neglected to see how much power it takes away from us in a lot of cases. And it's also increased inequality because only white collar jobs get to be remote, right? And
yeah.
It was like a really interesting set of arguments that we laid out on YouTube, and people got mad.
I also,
one thing, people love working from home, and as they should.
Well, they, you know, I sometimes think it's a little bit like staying at home. It is a little bit like staying from home and watching Netflix versus going out when you don't really feel like going out. And, you know, Guy Branum would often say, sometimes you have to leave the house to want to go out. Mm-hmm. And it may feel like it's exhausting at times, but there's something that happens despite yourself that made it good that you left the house in ways you may not understand. I also, you know, people would say talk to me about for advice, like, what should I do? Like, what kind of internship? Where am I going to learn the most? It's like, you should, if you can, like, try to get either an entry level job or an internship in a profession you're really interested in. But do not presume your goal in that first 6 months is to learn a lot. You will, and that's good. And you should try. But that is not an opportunity for you to gain the career experience you want exactly. It's your goal there to build a relationship with someone who will feel guilty for all the grunt shit you did, because that will be the thing that helps. They will become your ally,
yeah,
and give you advice and help you figure out your career as you move through life. And like, you just got to show up.
I think that's a good point. I put it less in terms of career advancement or that kind of thing, and more that, like, we are fundamentally social animals. We want to be around other people. We benefit from being around other people. You know, when prisoners are isolated, right, it's like it's a form of torture, right? Solitary confinement. And so, like, when we isolate ourselves from other folks, when we're too quick to do that, plenty of people have been forced to go to workplaces they don't want to, and that's bad. That's very bad as well, right? But, like, I think that we could all do, even as workers, to remember how much we get out of being around other people and how much, like, power that gives us in the workplace. Like union organizing is about looking someone else in the eyes and saying, we have a shared struggle, right? And, like, fuck the boss over there, but I'm talking to you right here. We haven't seen him for a week.
You're losing me a little bit.
I know your writers unionized a couple years ago.
I'm joking. I love the Crooked Union.
I like to make hosts do that when I come on shows.
But the other thing I've felt too about this debate that got a bit warped. One of the challenges I've noticed is that the people that write about work from home are writers. Mm. And writing is a profession that is, like, kind of annoying, and it can, like, I know for, like, the team that works at Love It or Leave It, like, they come in and write, and it's like they got to find a place that's quiet. We have, like, our anchor day is Wednesday, where everybody comes in the office, and that's our big day for doing a lot of the writing. And so I sometimes think too that a lot of the people that poo-poo the benefits of coming to an office just happen to be the kind of people whose jobs it is are to write articles on the internet from their apartments, and are like, why the fuck would I want to do this at the headquarters of Vox.com? You can eat shit. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. It's also, on the other hand, people like me who write, I want to acknowledge, like, when I talk about this, it's like, I like working with other people because I get to work with comedy writers, you know, people I enjoy being around. A lot of people don't. And so the problem with this conversation is it really contradicts a lot of people's, like, lived experiences either way, you know, and that's what makes it difficult. But I just think it's something that, like, we should, I'm just trying to pull people out of their perspective on it and, like, get a little bit of a broader view, because I think it's worth it.
Yeah. Thank you, Adam. His podcast, Factually, is available wherever you get your podcasts, and watch him on YouTube at The Adam Conover, and we'll be right back.
Hey, don't go anywhere. There's more of Love It or Leave It coming up.
Love It or Leave It is brought to you by Cook Unity. I love Cook Unity. I had a bunch of meals from Cook Unity. I had a Spanish kind of beef bowl that was great. I had pasta that I really liked. It was shrimp pasta, and there was a chicken and broccoli pasta that I really liked. I had a chicken Caesar wrap that was great. I love having Cook Unity. Basically, how I use it is a couple nights a week, I'll have it for breakfast, honestly. And it's like, I'll come home from the gym and I have just, like, a few minutes between getting home from the gym and wanting to get to the office. And so I can just throw one of those guys in the microwave. It comes out great. It's great food. You can, like, pick the ones that are high in protein and whatever you're looking for. I like getting ones that have a mix of carbs and vegetables and a lot of protein. And then it basically is, like, breakfast, but also I, like, use it basically as, like, an early lunch, and it's awesome. But I also sometimes have them for dinner. They're just a great flexible thing to have in your fridge. I get 4 meals a week right now. They come on Mondays. I put them in my fridge, and then basically during the week, the work week, I have a couple of these meals, and they're just excellent. The food tastes like someone just made it for you, because they did, in a small batch that morning. There are hundreds of dishes to choose from. The menu features 10 different dietary preferences and over 25 cuisines, and is updated constantly. Cook Unity is the first chef-led meal delivery service. that makes your meals in small batches inside local micro kitchens across the U.S., not factories. So every dish arrives with the kind of freshness you'd get at a restaurant itself. Meals from Michelin star chefs, James Beard winners, and Food Network stars. Go to cookunity.com/LOLI or use code LOLI before checkout for 50% off your first week. Taste what happens when real award-winning chefs make fresh, small batch meals for you. Go to cookunity.com/lowly, LOLI, or enter code LOLI before checkout and get 50% off your first order. That's 50% off your first order by using code LOWLY or going to cookunity.com/lowly.
Hi, I'm Alex Wagner. I do not need to tell you that being an American right now is a wild ride. But as a longtime journalist, I am not interested in the noise or the fear-mongering. I'm interested in the stories at the heart of the headlines. That is why every week on my show, Runaway Country, I'm joined by folks in the middle of the crossfire. From disillusioned MAHA moms to newly fired immigration judges to Epstein victims themselves, to understand what it means to live through this political chaos as an actual human being. And now I'm excited to tell you that Runaway Country is available ad-free to Friends of the Pod subscribers. Friends of the Pod is the subscription that supports the work Crooked does as an independent media company and gives you a ton of great bonus and ad-free content. With the midterms approaching, you are going to need more content to keep you sane. And now you can find Runaway Country right there. Subscribe now at crooked.com/friends.
And we're back. Woo! Please welcome to the stage a good sport who's good on sports. It's Sarah Tiana. Woo! Hi, thanks for being here.
Having me, hi. Thanks for having me. Whoa, look at us.
Yeah.
Look at us putting our feet up.
You currently host the show Women's Sports Now on ESPN. Mm-hmm. What is your favorite women's team to watch here in LA? I'm an Angel City season ticket holder. Come on.
Love right. Angel City. Just filmed a TikTok video with Casey and Giselle.
Cool.
Very fun. Love Angel City. Just got the new swag from Anthropologie for them. love the Sparks. You know, I do. I really do enjoy this. I'm from Georgia, so I should love the Atlanta Dream, but I just can't.
Why can't you?
I just started going to Sparks games. That was my first introduction into the WNBA, and like, I just love NECA. I'm really sad that Kelsey Plum left. Like, you know, like they're just really fun. I do have notes, but about the Sparks, but we can leave that for another.
Like on the design of the logo or anything, or like the playing.
Where do I start? A little bit of the playing, but mostly the merch. I'm like really sad about the merch because when you go to a Sparks game, you can't just buy a jersey in the store, which is really disheartening because there's
not?
Like 18 LeBron jerseys.
You can't buy a jersey.
Buy, like,
why
a
not?
Kelsey, they're just not for sale. They will have like a retro Lisa Leslie jersey, and you're like, cool. Yeah, of course. Like I probably already have this.
I do have some notes on the food options at. Mm-hmm.
I know
BMO.
Sounds... Oh, BMO.
Angel City.
Yeah.
It's
the same as SoFi, like where you're like, this is a new stadium. They should have lots of great options, but they're just mid. Yeah. They try too hard. They'll try to do like something fancy, and you're like, I just really want a good hot dog or really great chicken tenders with like, you know, honey barbecue or something. You know, like something hot honey.
Yeah. This wasn't broken. Yeah. I want a fucking helmet mm-hmm. made of plastic filled with goddamn nachos.
Absolutely. That's Dodger Stadium. I would cheer for Al-Qaeda before the Dodgers, but like I love the food at Dodger Stadium. Like no notes.
You're also, you've worked on quite a few, where we are. We can leave this part. I don't care. Dear audience, we cut everything where we riffed about Al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
You're also a great joke writer. You've written a bunch of roasts. We had W. Kamau Bell on this pod. He hates the roasting. He thinks roasts are dead. Agree or disagree?
It's hard to disagree, but I don't. I think roasting used to be an art. You're only supposed to roast the ones you love, because if you roast people that you don't like, then it just becomes hate. You know, then it just becomes mean. It was like when we had Ann Coulter on the Rob Lowe roast, like people were just doing jokes about her that were super mean. And I was in charge of her. And I was like,
making sure her bowl was full and uh-huh. there was enough water
yes,
in her tank.
Yeah, had enough blood to drink, you know, stuff like that. And at one point they were like, go tell her to laugh. And she was, I was like, because she was like just sitting there like angry the whole time. And I was like, Anne, you know, like you just like when people make jokes about you, just try to laugh. And she goes, well, I'll laugh when it's funny. And I was like, you're not wrong. Literally everyone's just called you a cunt for like an hour. You know, I think Nikki Glaser had the best joke about her, which was like, Ann Coulter, the only man Ann Coulter will ever make happy is the Mexican who digs her grave. It's a great joke.
Great joke.
Nikki Glaser, the goat.
That's a great joke.
Yeah, great joke. But, you know, I mean, I think it used to be you only roast the ones you love. And now, you know, we're roasting people, you know, who have been roasted before or, you know, who like maybe aren't as roasted. Like when we had Tom Brady, you know, no one had made fun of Tom Brady. It was so exciting. And lately it's just become like, who can we, you know, roast next? And who will take the job? Like who will do it? And Kevin Hart, who I love, who, you know, who is very funny and incredible. And I thought the roast was very, very entertaining and lovely. But it's like, you know, we do make fun of Kevin Hart all the time. Kevin Hart makes fun of Kevin Hart all the time.
Yeah, I find myself when I watch the roasts, because I'm like, because the correspondence dinners are basically a form of a roast. Mm-hmm. And I love the craft of these kinds of jokes. And I just find myself watching them and just like, I can't help but like write the material that I wish they were doing just as I'm watching it. Just like, come on. Like, there's like such a, it's like, it's very, you're right. This is the point that Kamau made as well, that like it doesn't have the personal touch that it would have had in the past, where people who really knew each other, even when they first started airing on Comedy Central, there were people who knew each other.
Yes, they were friends, you know. And like I think in Kevin's roast, there were so many lovely parts. Like I think, you know, Naeem, who is his opener, like that was really beautiful and personal, you know. And Big J, who had known him for a long time, like those felt very personal. And then there were, you know, some more of his friends there, but you know, I definitely, we want to connect, we want it to be real. I mean, I've roast battled people before, and people have been like asked me to roast them, and I'm like, you know, we're not friends. Like, why would I roast you? Because when you roast someone, you have to do tons of research on them. And I'm not going to kind of waste that energy on people that I don't feel like deserve it. And, you know, when I'm writing a joke about you, especially as a friend, I'm not trying to hurt your feelings. I'm trying to impress you. Like, I want you to love the joke so much that you want it for your act.
Yeah, because we did a roast at our rehearsal dinner. Mm-hmm. That we turned that into a roast. And people really brought it.
Yeah.
And they were so mean. Hallie's here. She roasted the ever-loving shit out of me at that. Mm-hmm. And it was great. Has there ever been a roast where you've written a joke that didn't get used that you thought would have just absolutely killed?
So, yeah, during the James Franco roast, I wrote a joke for Jeff Ross, and he did it in the room. And it was, James Franco, you're an insult to Italian actors everywhere. I bet James Gandolfini is trying to roll over in his grave right now. And, like, it killed him. Like, he it was right after Gandolfini died, so it was, like, super topical. And I was, and it had murdered in all the rehearsals. And then when Jeff said it, he kind of did a second, he paused in the middle of it, and then so they cut it because of like the way he delivered it, and he didn't do a retake in the moment, which is totally fine, because I was like, I'll just get to keep that joke forever. Like, I'll get to like use that on other people.
That's great. Now, sort of kind of breaks the rule a little bit, because that's not really a joke about James Franco. That's a joke about James Gandolfini. Yes. He really caught a stray there, though. Yes. He wouldn't really mind.
It's just
mind.
A fat joke.
He was dead. Yeah, it was. Yeah. It was, in
just
fact,
a fat joke.
Simply a fat joke.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes those are really fun. I mean, I remember roasting Ralphie May, because we were like, at the time we were pitching Roast Battle, and so we were like pitching it to HBO or something, and so me and Ralphie decided to roast each other. And I remember it was like right after the Ray Rice scandal had happened in the NFL. You remember he played for the Ravens, and it was like a big domestic violence scandal. And I said, Ralphie kind of reminded me of Ray Rice. I was like, you're not an athlete, but no one would want to be on an elevator with you either. And that was like one of my favorite. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, Ralphie was like, I want to use this. I go, yeah, you should use it.
That's a good joke.
So that's, you know.
There is something about like the roast thing too that's about, yes, it's about like going after people you love, but also about that like, this is a space where we do those jokes. Like, and part of it is just the craft of a really good fat joke, even if on some level we're like, we know we shouldn't be doing this, but this is the space where we do it.
Yes, and I think, you know, when you really love somebody, you want to do stuff about them that you know that they will love or appreciate. And so with Ralphie, it was definitely, you know, I do a couple of fat jokes, but then I do jokes about him being a bad father or a bad husband, you know? So it's like, you kind of spread them out and then maybe you just like trickle a little fat in there.
So, yeah, like
he does on his salads.
Yeah. Or right, or like, you know, making a roast. Now, I did want to ask you about a lot of sports news. Mm-hmm. In a segment we're calling Don't Hate the Player.
Oh.
And basically, I just want to go through a couple of news stories just to understand why people are mad at an athlete.
Okay.
First up, why are people mad at Indiana Fever guard Sophie Cunningham?
Well, where do I start? So Sophie Cunningham, she's recently become outspoken about trans athletes. Specifically biological male transitioning into female and bringing that into locker rooms in the game. And so people are definitely upset about her with that. And even when they've asked her to kind of correct her stance, she's kind of doubled down on it. And I think, you know, in the sports world, it's obviously a nuanced conversation. And she is on a team with Caitlin Clark, and by proximity, she gets a kind of... her and there's another player on the team, they're called Tres Leches because they're the three white girls on the team. And, you know, so they already have like a, they call her MAGA Barbie. So, you know, they like, I think the right is always looking for someone famous to cling on to. I mean, you've seen the lineup for America 250th, like anybody who may have done something.
Fog a mirror, we want you in the thing.
Anytime. Yeah. And if you like Trump, then you're there. So I think she's become kind of the face of, you know, like Riley Gaines went to a game and it's like, I don't think you've ever been to a WNBA, you know, like, so they're kind of clinging on to her as like this beacon of, you know, outspoken right-wing journalism. Yeah, I know. It's a very difficult conversation.
Well, because part of it is like, yeah. You know, people need to be able to have, of course, people are free to criticize what she's saying, but also I think sometimes it's like, given that I think most of the country at this point has now decided, basically they if you like kind of, you blur your eyes and like look at all the polling, it would say people don't want trans people to be discriminated against mm-hmm. in their work and in their lives. They want people to be able to live with themselves, but they have concerns about, they're concerned about young people and they're concerned about sports. They really, and so there's gotta be, cause I think like then the coverage, especially from the left, then says that, she's anti-trans.
Right.
And then it's like, well, hold on. If we define anti-trans as people who agree with this, then a lot of people are going to think they're anti-trans. But at the same time, I understand those who are like, well, I don't want to concede here because they don't care about sports. They really want to make trans people feel unsafe everywhere.
Yeah. Yes. You know? And
so
I think
it puts the athletes in a tough position too.
For sure. Because they're also the people playing the game. Like I shouldn't be involved in this commentary because I'm not in the locker room. I don't know. But I just know that there's arguments on both sides. There's no argument to the advantage of a biological male transitioning into a female that somehow that makes you, it's not like a man just puts on a wig and like goes out. Like there are so many different drugs in their body. Like it's been proven that your lung capacity goes down. Like there, it doesn't mean that you're automatically advantaged just because you had testosterone at one point. So I think that there's a lot of different research that needs to happen and no one's really giving way to that and no one's really proving it. And honestly, I will care more about the 7 trans athletes trying to get in professional sports when the Epstein files are released, because I think it's all a distraction.
Why are people mad at Aaron Rodgers?
Oh, Aaron Rodgers. So Aaron Rodgers recently said that Dr. Fauci, Tony Fauci, who he calls him, as if they're on a first name basis, as if Aaron Rodgers knows anyone's first name, that he should be in prison, that he's a criminal. You know, Aaron Rodgers famously said he was immunized when they asked him if he took the COVID vaccine during COVID. And he said, I've been immunized. And then it later came out that he did not take the vaccine. He was very anti-vaccine. And he was like, I didn't mislead the media. And so when he's recently said he was married, which everyone is shocked by. And everyone keeps saying he's been matrimonialized because we've never seen his wife. Not that we need to for that to be proof. But, you know, he's just a polarizing figure and he's always been outspoken in right leaning politics. So
what was he what was he, how could he be immune? What did he mean? Did he mean that he had like natural immunity or?
Yes, that he was taking ivermectin. He said he had a long talk with Joe Rogan, his doctor, apparently. And that made, you know, that he had taken all the precautions necessary to not contract the disease. But he also refused to wear a mask. So there's that. I know.
And finally, we have Motown legend Martha Reeves singing the national anthem before the first women's pro baseball league. Who could be mad about this?
And the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night. Mm.
10 out of 10, no notes.
Yeah, no notes. Absolutely my favorite national anthem of all time. It was definitely a rough start to the Women's Professional Baseball League. And apparently she had had a couple conversations with those backup singers about the harmonizing because there were two country singers who got paired with her. It was, you know, it was the first day. And so I'm trying to look at it as, you know, there were some missteps.
She put out a statement that said, the field conditions were wet and windy, and without stage monitors, I wasn't able to hear myself as I normally would. While it wasn't the performance I had hoped for, I'm grateful to have been there to support these remarkable athletes in this groundbreaking league. That makes me sad.
I think
it's sweet.
You know what's even better than that national anthem? Before the national anthem, you know how like before a national anthem at a sporting event, they'll be like, please rise if you're able and remove your caps as we sing, as we celebrate America. In the Women's Professional Baseball League, they said, please rise and remove your hats, caps, visors, and fedoras. And I was like, you know your audience. You know? Like, it was fantastic.
Yeah, please remove your Brandy Carlisle branded fedora.
Yes.
Before we sing the national anthem. Well, thank you, Sarah. And catch Women's Sports Now Thursdays at 3 p.m. on ESPN. And listen to Sports Bitches.
My podcast.
Wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be right back.
Hey, don't go anywhere. There's more of Love It or Leave It coming up.
Love It or Leave It is brought to you by Built. Here's a question. Are you getting rewarded for paying your rent or mortgage right now? Did you know that was even an option? If the answer is no, you need to check out Built. Become a Built member means earning points on every housing payment, no matter where you live. Built points can be redeemed for flights, hotels, Lyft rides, Amazon.com purchases, future housing payments, and more. You can use your points for fitness classes and for restaurants and for Amazon.com, but there are dozens of ways to redeem. Members also get access to the AI neighborhood concierge right in the Built app. It doesn't just give local recommendations. It takes action. From paying rent and reserving dinner tables to booking fitness classes and ordering lifts, it handles tasks seamlessly while applying your member benefits across 50,000 plus partner merchants. First, you download the Built app. Second, link any credit card or debit card to the app so purchases at your local spots become even more rewarding. And third, ask the neighborhood concierge in the app pretty much anything. Download the Built app and join the membership for where you live at joinbuilt.com/loveit. That's joinbuilt.com/loveit. Use our link so they know we sent you.
Hi, I'm Alex Wagner. I do not need to tell you that being an American right now is a wild ride. But as a longtime journalist, I am not interested in the noise or the fear-mongering. I'm interested in the stories at the heart of the headlines. That is why every week on my show, Runaway Country, I'm joined by folks in the middle of the crossfire. From disillusioned MAHA moms to newly fired immigration judges to Epstein victims themselves, to understand what it means to live through this political chaos as an actual human being. And now I'm excited to tell you that Runaway Country is available ad-free to Friends of the Pod subscribers. Friends of the Pod is the subscription that supports the work Crooked does as an independent media company and gives you a ton of great bonus and ad-free content. With the midterms approaching, you are going to need more content to keep you sane. And now you can find Runaway Country right there. Subscribe now at crooked.com/friends.
And we're back. Woo! Please welcome to the stage the man behind the manifesto. It's Dan Taberski. Hi, nice to meet you. Thanks for being here. Hi.
Hi.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
So I want to talk about your new podcast, which is about manifestos,
yeah.
What they are, where they went, if we should bring them back.
Mm.
But I actually was excited to meet you because you did the podcast Missing Richard Simmons.
I did.
And I want to tell you something. So do you know about do people know about this podcast, Missing Richard Simmons?
Yeah.
And so basically, Richard Simmons just disappeared from public life.
Yeah.
And you went on a journey to find out why.
Correct.
And to find him.
Yeah.
And you didn't.
No. Well, I know. Yeah, I knew where he was. I
mean, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
In his house.
Yes.
But you didn't talk to him.
I did not.
And he didn't talk to you.
No. No.
And you never really saw him.
No.
But you learned a lot.
I did.
About what led him to become so reclusive.
Yeah, a lot of it's guesswork because I never talked to him. And so you're sort of, but yeah, for sure. Like it was a long journey of figuring out why he would do something like that. Why he would just be Richard Simmons for the most public celebrity for 40 years and then stop on a dime.
And can I tell you that I have a little theory that I wanted to run by you ever since that I listened to the podcast, which is, and I'm sorry, I'm just going to say what it is. I thought, what if he gained a bunch of weight and didn't want to be seen until he lost the weight, mm-hmm. but then couldn't lose the weight?
Yes, 100%. That was definitely one of the things we talked about. That was definitely a possibility, for sure.
But we don't know.
No, we do know. He didn't gain the weight. He didn't gain weight.
We know that. How do you know that?
There was a public, the police went and did a wellness check to make sure after the podcast, they were like, okay, we got to check this out.
It was after the podcast.
It was during the podcast. It was actually during the podcast. They did
the what was airing.
Check. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, but sure. It wasn't in the show.
At the very end, it was in the last episode.
So they checked.
Talked about it. They checked and they said he's normal. He was. They said he was fit. They said he was. That he was in great shape. Like they said that he was. He was fine. He was lucid. He was.
Then what was the deal?
He. I don't know. I mean, a lot of it's conjecture. But I think ultimately it was that he had spent so many years giving so much empathy to so many people. Not being sort of professionally trained on how to do something like that and maintain that sort of work and sort of protect yourself at the same time.
He has to go to the coffee shop and he has to be Richard Simmons at the coffee shop.
He doesn't have to, but he was always Richard Simmons. I've had dinner with him in public and it is wild. He'd be like, I'll go to the bathroom. And I swear to God, the next minute we saw him jumping outside the window and he was outside on the street jumping up and down with people. Like he couldn't stop doing it. He couldn't stop doing it. And so the thinking is that he basically, the only way to stop being Richard Simmons was to stop cold turkey. And that meant all the people that he was helping, all the people that he loved, all of his friends. He never spoke to them again and he never said goodbye.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really a wild, tender, moving story. He's an incredible person who had a really wild ending.
Yeah. I sympathize because everywhere I go, people want me to just put on this show.
Totally. Dance, monkey, dance.
And it's like, I'm sorry, I'm just off duty today. I can't give you that thing you're desperate for.
I get it. But you love it. You love it a little bit. Yeah.
So your new podcast is called Manifesto.
Yeah.
And now, look, I would say most people have a negative connotation with the term manifesto because of, for example, the Unabomber.
Yeah.
But you have your own manifesto in the program, 11 points.
Yeah.
Give us a couple of them.
God. I mean, the first one is you got to get mad. Manifestos are amazing for channeling your anger. And which is where a lot of this started for me, because I'm just so fucking angry all the time about the state of the world and the state of the cynicism out there and the shitty people who are running things and the direction we're going in. And like, it's just this sort of thing that's like bubbling in me all the time. And I have arguments with people that I don't even know in my head all the time, people that I agree with. You know what I mean? Even more so than with the people I hate. Like, I'm more angry at the people I agree with, but they say things the wrong way, or they just like are annoying, or like, just anger. And manifestos are amazing for channeling anger and turning it into action.
Sometimes we'll be, so when I was a speechwriter, I would often like kind of procrastinate/think about what I was writing, and I didn't realize, but I'd kind of walk around various government buildings kind of muttering to myself a little bit, which is sort of part of, I don't realize how much when I'm thinking, I'm like kind of moving my mouth.
Yeah.
And now my husband will be, we'll just be walking on the street or in the car, and they'll be like, who are you in argument with right now?
Yeah. And? Who?
I was like, well, sometimes it's like, I just to admit, sometimes it's such a crazy flight of fancy. Yeah. So for example, they'll be like, oh, who are you arguing with? And I'll be like, oh, I'm not arguing. I'm actually on the witness stand explaining how that road rage incident led to an accident that wasn't my fault, but the judge doesn't believe me.
See, that sounds totally normal.
I think that's crazy.
It is crazy.
I don't, do other people do that? Do your little, they go that far, like you're all of a sudden like all the way down the road fully beyond and now it's real, but you're so far.
You get lost, right? And you're like, wait, where the fuck am I? Why am I arguing with imaginary person number two? And I'm like, yeah, it's insane.
But see, sometimes I think, in part because of social media, in part because of my nature, that if I'm not careful, my ruminating over the little frustrations or big frustrations in the world, that I then find them and see them. And so I see a world. So every day I drive to work and someone cuts you off and someone lets you in and I see a world of people cutting me off. I don't remember a world of people letting me in because my natural inclination and my proneness to thinking about the bad moments makes me think that's what the world is. And so is the manifesto really one that you ought to be directing at Dan Tversky?
Yes, this is my manifest. This is my way of dealing with my anger. I'm angry.
Yeah.
But you seem angry too. Like, you seem like an angry guy. Yeah. I mean, I don't mean that. I mean that as the biggest compliment I could give.
The way that I would say, I would say that I feel things deeply and briefly. I am often quite mad.
Deeply and briefly?
Deeply and quite briefly.
It's a great combination.
Yeah, no. It's great for my colleagues. But what else is on your manifesto? You wrote your points. What are things that are on your list?
I mean, it's about how to write the things I want to see in manifestos. Manifestos aren't just about anger. They're about having a vision for the future, right? It's like saying, this shit that's going on right now, it sucks, and we're going to change it, and here's how we're going to do it, and everybody, let's fucking go. And so some of them are really simple, like pretend you're an army. Like, the Unabomber used to sign his manifesto as FC, meaning Freedom Club, as if there was this big sort of network of people who agreed with Ted Kaczynski when it was just this guy.
Yeah, and we're take a moment to say that we hate the Unabomber and what he did.
Okay. No, I agree. I hate the Unabomber and what he did. Of course, obviously. But a lot of people think that some of the stuff that was in his manifesto, people are... It was beyond the pale in the 90s to look at his manifesto as anything other than incredibly violent and fuck you for doing it and like go to prison for the rest of your life. 30 years later, you can look back on it and think like, yeah, this person had some rage and a lot of that rage was about technology and what it was doing to our society. Wasn't that crazy?
Well, so there have been moments where people have, I think, to get a rise out of people, reproduce parts of the Unabomber manifesto because people think of him fairly. He's associated with his terrible crimes.
Of course.
But actually there was there was a critique in there. Now, I do not believe the fact that he gains this attention because he did these terrible things, I think is a reason to be cautious about kind of whatever, holding these things up. And I know you're saying, I'm just sort of putting this on the context-free internet, I think part of what we're talking about is distilling Martin Luther nailing the theses on the worms or whatever the fuck.
Yeah.
I don't remember. It was a long time ago.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mrs. Kagan, AP European history. I wonder if she's alive.
Especially with mass shooters, like mass shooter manifestos, I don't really consider them manifestos at all, even though people call them manifestos. You need a vision for the future, and mass shooters don't have a vision for the future. 9 times out of 10, it's the last thing they're ever going to do. And so what they're putting out is a cynical document to begin with. A manifesto should take that anger and turn it into action, and use poetry and inspiration and move people to action. That's what a manifesto can be.
Common sense.
Yeah, that's an old one.
Sure.
Yeah, Occupy Wall Street started with a manifesto. Most people don't know that.
Yeah, and that worked out.
It didn't have, it 100%, it did not work out necessarily as planned, but it moved hundreds of thousands of people. Like, to send an email, the two activists sent an email to 90,000 followers saying, that's it, we're not going to fucking do this anymore. September 17th, everybody go to Wall Street, we're just going to sit down until somebody does something. And people showed up, and they kept showing up, and they kept showing up, and they really turned that anger ultimately into nothing. But long term, it really motivated a whole generation of people. You know, we were just talking about Bernie Sanders. A lot of Bernie Sanders followers were motivated by Occupy Wall Street.
I also think it's a rep, right? Like, Occupy Wall Street was a rep. Like, it was people getting their reps of just doing a bit of activism that maybe they hadn't done before or seeing other people doing it. So I don't want to be too cynical about it because I remember finding it very
cynical. Yeah.
No, but I remember at the time feeling... kind of like inspired by the fact that so many people were willing to kind of just stake out that space.
Yes, but also disappointing because the manifesto didn't say, here's what we're going to do about it. It said, we're angry, we're going to go sit, and they could never agree on what the point was. They can never agree on what they actually wanted to have happen.
Here are some things from my manifesto.
Yeah.
People should be more direct.
Okay.
I'm sick of it. I feel like I pay a directness tax because I'm rude and you're not saying what you want. Movies should have intermissions because...
How long? Even 90-minute movies?
I would say any movie that's above 1 hour and 50 minutes.
Even if you're watching it at home?
Well, I mean, you can keep... You don't need to... You can fast forward.
So you're talking about going to the movies?
Yeah, I'm saying...
When's the last time you went to a movie?
The Odyssey.
Besides that?
Before that. I don't know. I love the movie. Shut up. This is the problem. You said manifesto that I was saying the fucking nitpicking. Okay, here's my real... This is my big... We should shift payroll taxes to income and corporate taxes, but we don't because companies pay a tax for employing a person and get a deduction for hiring a robot. And I wish more people talked about this, even though it's a giant change and hard to do because payroll taxes are a huge share of federal taxes and it's how we fund social safety net programs and Medicare and Social Security. Mm-hmm. But... just because we get such a huge share of our revenue from payroll taxes doesn't mean we aren't wrong for not figuring out a way to change it over the long term. And one company that makes $1 billion but has thousands of employees, I think we should collectively view as, if all else equal, better than a company that makes $1 billion and employs 5 people in a world where we want people to be able to work and earn a living. And so perhaps our tax code should be fundamentally changed to address that, and nobody's doing it. And that's on my manifesto.
I think that's a great point in a manifesto. I think a little bit louder and a little bit shorter and like a little bit more like
we weren't
little
taking
poetry
notes.
In it.
We weren't looking for notes on it. No, and then finally, everyone dunks on Nepo babies, but if your goal is to become successful and have a family, your goal is to create Nepo babies. So in a sense, you hate the children in your own fantasy.
True.
You know?
Yeah. Telling truths. You're telling truths.
I'm kidding. You should give me notes. I shouldn't have said that.
No.
No, I feel bad about that. See, this is my problem. I'm not a manifesto guy. I'm more of a...
All right, I'm nervous to say
try it out. Right. Try it out. Yeah. Nah, sometimes. Here's the thing, though. I will say this. I'm brave when I'm mad. And that's, I think, the value sometimes of anger.
Yeah. I'm brave when I'm mad, too, actually. I don't have any fear of physical, of anybody hurting me. Like you know, like people, you see people on the street, like even though you know they're going to get their ass kicked, like, I feel like I'm one of those people.
I think that I would.
Like, I don't care. Just hurt me.
I think my fear response, and we'll kick this. There's a kind of innate Ashkenazi. I'm the survivors of all the Jews that ran. you know, that'll kick in something kind of the sort of the meerkat energy of the Ashkenazi Jew. But thank you, Dan Taberski. Dan Taberski's manifesto is now available on Audible and wherever you get your podcasts. And we'll be right back. And we're back. First of all, let's welcome Sarah and Adam back to the stage. Hi, come on in. Come sit back down. All right, great. Thank you all for being here. We've had a lot of fun tonight.
Mm-hmm.
We learned a lot, and I said a lot of things, some of which my producers think I should not have said. So it's time we look back on them in a segment we call Second Thoughts. Here's how it works. The team has assembled a list of my flubs and whiffs from the evening, things they wish I had done different or better, and I'm going to run through them. If you have any second thoughts about this evening, whatever they may be, this would be a good opportunity to share them, and they're welcome because it's an opportunity for us all to just take a moment to reflect and things we wish we had said a little differently or done a little better, because that's okay. We all make mistakes, you know? We all do. That's what I think. First, my impression of Trump as a toddler had a sort of Transylvania accent.
I can't even imagine Trump as a toddler because I feel like he still is. So I'd like,
yeah, you don't have to imagine.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
I promoted a conspiracy theory about Stevie Wonder faking being blind for money. I don't even know why the for money thing slipped in there.
But I think that's a very valid.
A lot of people believe that. Have you seen TikTok? A lot of people believe that.
Where he caught the mic stand? People really, there's a video clip where he kind of catches a mic stand. It's like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know.
It's maybe like Daredevil.
Mic stands make sounds.
Superhero.
Yeah.
They do make sounds. This is such an important point, Adam Conover. Oh, this is from the Adam portion of the show. I tried to reject your humanity to defend AI.
Oh, we got some strong opinions on the writing staff about AI. No, I talked over you a little bit. I feel badly about that.
But see, I don't think you should, because that's both of us, and that's how this was good. There's no, it's as much, no. We're just a shared responsibility.
Hell yeah.
We're told, you know, that's nothing to feel bad about. I describe driving while on coke as cool. Let's see, during the Sarah conversation, there was a brief point where we did some version of Al-Qaeda. You got to hand it to them.
Yeah.
We'll probably come to regret that. It was cut from the show, but it did happen.
And when you say you got to hand it to them, you mean like a severed hand that's been cut off, right? That's what you mean?
Yeah.
You should add that twice. Give me a hand for that.
I imply that I'm a better roast writer than the ones I'm watching on Netflix. I just sort of casually said I'm writing better jokes in my head than what I'm seeing on the screen. But isn't that every writer?
I think when we watch the roast, we all put ourselves in there and we go, oh, this is what I would have said. I do wish that I would have said that my biggest complaint about the roast, even though I'm a huge fan and I will consume all of them and I want to be a part of all of them and have a job on all of them, is that the roast used to be really personal. And now it feels like they're less personal, but their jokes are getting personal. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I know what you mean.
Yeah,
you know,
it doesn't feel like they know each other,
right.
But the jokes are meaner.
Yeah, they're more targeted as if...
You know. Also, you're not funnier than those writers. I know a bunch of those writers.
Yeah.
They're great writers. You're funnier than the comics, John.
Oh.
The comics are the ones, they're doing the jokes bad. They're picking the wrong jokes. One of them is Tony Hinchcliffe. You know, it's, you're better than them. The writers are great.
That's such an important point. And I agree.
Thank you.
Let's see. With Dan, struggling to accept that my Richard Simmons weight gain theory is incorrect. I can't take the facts. I simply believe that that's what the answer is.
I think that's okay if you believe that. I don't think... he's dead, so...
Whatever led me to need to specify that I hate the Unabomber.
I don't know. You were really like...
Listen.
Like 30 years ago. Like, nobody's
here's the thing.
That you think that you love the Unabomber.
Like, oh... sweet Dan in his podcast.
I mean,
didn't
we all kind of love the Unabomber?
Jesus, you know? Christ.
He was on TV every night, you know, and OJ, we all loved OJ.
We loved following the story.
It was the 90s.
I bought the hoodie. I was excited.
Yeah. People who...
I'm not going down for this.
Statement.
Hate the Unabomber. Fucking Ted Kaczynski with that dead-eyed stare in that little fucked up cabin in the woods.
Yeah, I was going to say...
Blowing up people.
I think we all dreamed of having a cabin in the woods and just getting away.
Made packages scary.
He seemed like the only happy guy in America.
Yeah.
He looked nothing like that drawing. He must have been so fucking thrilled when he saw that drawing. He's like, I'm free forever.
You know who really hated working from home was Ted Kaczynski. Don't come for me on the work from home. It's very, no one should take away, you should be able to work from home. I just want to, that's what I regret. People are so emotional about it.
Look at you arguing with, look at you, Adam Conover, arguing with the comments section.
Adam,
you're not mad at people understanding you. You're arguing with people that are choosing not to understand.
That's true.
So how are you going to argue with them successfully if their purpose is to not understand what you're saying?
I will say too that I agreed with you, so people can come with me. But I enjoy working from home when I'm working on shows that are not comedies, but when I'm writing in a comedy room, I want to be with other comedians, because that's when you like kind of think of things just in conversation. Like, you'll be making fun of someone else's joke and that will lead to a story, and then that will lead to a new joke.
Yeah.
Which you can't get at home.
Yeah.
I think that's such an important point. And I also do want to say...
he wasn't even listening.
Yes, I was. Yes, I...
He wasn't even listening.
I was
he's like
listening.
But every one of my bosses...
Your point was that...
Everyone
that,
out there who had a shitty office, you should get to work from home.
You should get to work from home.
But also, you should go outside sometimes and make sure you remind yourself to do that.
Yeah, such an important point, Adam. The good things are good and the bad things are bad. People should get to do the good things.
The comments get
mad. Sometimes going to the office sucks, but that doesn't mean on the whole we don't benefit from having an office to go to. Comedy sucks when people are doing it from home. It's so much better if people are in a room together getting to riff, and you won't know. It's a dog that doesn't bark. The Zoom rooms, they're grueling for people, but you don't know the work that was never produced, the things that never happened. It's not just this idea that, like, I feel like there was this idea that people want to go to the office because there's something magical and sort of kismet that happens around the water cooler kind of diminishing. And it's like, it's somewhere in between happenstance and like something mystical and just the value of people and what people do when they're together. You know, and I feel like it shouldn't be diminished. And I agree with you. And that's all I want to say about that. Finally, I'm sorry for speculating about whether or not my AP European history teacher is dead. And if Mrs. Kagan, you were great. And that's our show. That's our show. Thank you so much to Adam Conover, Sarah Tiana, and Dan Taberski. There are 88 days until the midterms, and we'll be back next week with Lauren Weedman and Lisa Traeger. Have a great weekend. Love It or Leave It is a Crooked Media production. Our show is produced by Kendra James, Bill McGrath, Kelsey Gante, and me, John Lovett. Our production team includes Hallie Kiefer, Sarah Lazarus, Raman Borsellino, Peter Miller, David Tolles, Claudia Shang, Jay Banks, Gavin Purcell, and Matt DeGroat. And our staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America East.
Hi, I'm Alex Wagner. I do not need to tell you that being an American right now is a wild ride. But as a longtime journalist, I am not interested in the noise or the fear-mongering. I'm interested in the stories at the heart of the headlines. That is why every week on my show, Runaway Country, I'm joined by folks in the middle of the crossfire. From disillusioned MAHA moms to newly fired immigration judges to Epstein victims themselves, to understand what it means to live through this political chaos as an actual human being. And now I'm excited to tell you that Runaway Country is available ad-free to Friends of the Pod subscribers. Friends of the Pod is the subscription that supports the work Crooked does as an independent media company and gives you a ton of great bonus and ad-free content. With the midterms approaching, you are going to need more content to keep you sane. And now you can find Runaway Country right there. Subscribe now at crooked.com/friends.